Thank you for joining Risk and Business, the Advent IM podcast. Our guest today is Chris Recker from the respected law firm Troers & Hamlins, and we're talking ransomware and data protection post-Brexit. Sadly, unfortunately, due to a failure of my normal podcast mic and the remote nature of the recording, I must apologise about some of the sound quality at certain times, but unfortunately, it was unavoidable. But we hope you still enjoy the podcast. Thank you very much for joining me, Chris. And today we're going to be talking about ransomware, changes in ransomware, and also data protection and privacy post-Brexit. So starting with ransomware then, I wonder, Chris, if you have noticed, as I have, the huge increase in the level of ransom that is being required and the funds therefore being generated has grown so much in the last couple of years. If you were to go by the news, that would be because the nature of the organisations that are being attacked has changed, and we're seeing much bigger businesses and organisations, including even municipalities, being crippled by ransomware. Have you noticed the same thing?
Yeah, it's really interesting. We've seen an uptick in ransomware incidents during the COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, some of that may come from, unfortunately, some organisations, focusing on keeping the lights on, which is absolutely what they should be doing. But, you know, but equally, cyber criminals are taking advantage of, you know, the people's guards being down. You know, that's everything from kind of phishing emails being sent out on the day, staff are being sent from home. Right through to, you know, what could have been a more calculated incident over, which takes a longer to propagate and to actually trigger. In terms of the size of the ransoms, we've seen a variety, but actually some of the ones we've seen, that the actual ransom figures are not huge, and it actually starts to introduce lots of quite interesting thoughts about, you know, to what extent can or should a ransom be paid? What do we know about the person that may be being paid? Are they potentially funding terrorism or helping to launder the proceeds of crime? Does that create a regulatory issue for them? Is there a sensible asset recovery strategy that can be deployed, which, you know, allows somebody to potentially pay a ransom in cryptocurrency and then secure an injunction in parallel with a view to pulling it back from an exchange when it's transferred on after? And there are lots of kind of interesting thoughts around that, but we've definitely seen it being used as a method of mass disruption. And I think that's the kind of key tool. It's also sometimes used as I think I've said this before, you know, the knock at the front door when they're doing things at the back door.
Yes, that can be the case, and we do see the same thing happen with distributed denial of service attacks.
It's caused us to have some really interesting conversations with clients around things like, you know, can I pay this to get my data back? You know, what are the chances of me getting my data back? How much do we know from our investigations about this particular strain of ransomware? How does it move laterally within a network?
And that's obviously going to be a major problem if you've effectively got a flat network.
What does it do? Have other people been affected by this? If so, what industries have those other people been in? Is it the same? Is this something that's targeting a certain section of the of a market? And all of those types of things, and you know, ransomware generally is something that we're definitely seeing more of. And the challenge is, you know, the moment you start having that data accessed, you're then talking about potential notifications to regulators. You're talking about disruption to your own organization. And actually, the kind of thing that I would say that is the most disruptive is the onward discussions that you have to have with your own clients, with our clients' clients, around, you know, the contingency, around the information that you can share, particularly if there are contractual arrangements which require things like notifications where there are these types of incidents, because then the clients get nervous for the reasons that you'd expect.
Absolutely, because at that point they're not just making a decision for their own business, they're making a decision for all of the businesses that are effectively connected to their network as well. So this is not a unilateral decision.
Yeah.
So some of those questions, Chris, about, you know, whether we morally, you know, should be paying a ransom, I think this kind of stuff requires a great deal more scrutiny and discussion, because just because you can do something doesn't necessarily mean that you should.
I agree. And the challenge is, I mean, at the outset, pull the moral aspect to one side. Is this a solution that will get you back into the position that you were in? And the answer to that is, you just don't know.
There aren't any guarantees, because you are, after all, dealing with criminals. So there's no guarantee that you're going to get your access to your files or system back that they have hijacked. There's also no guarantee that they won't then subsequently sell that information on, as we're seeing a great deal more of that kind of activity happening now.
Yeah, and I mean, you can, to some extent, if you can find information about the strain of ransomware, it's possible that you can actually, with some certainty, try and, identify the extent to which it's possible that you will get your data back. Because, you know, for the major strains, these are strains that are sold on the dark web, on marketplaces, and the people that create and use this ransomware want people to know that if the ransom is paid, that they will get their data back. Because the moment there's a, you know, the moment there is a suggestion that they won't, then nobody will pay. Mm-hmm. So they need to make sure the ransom is being used properly and the software is being used properly, which is quite a strange concept when you think of it like
is,
that.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Dealing with the question, going back and dealing with the question in parts. You know, is it likely to be the result that you wanted to get? Because you can imagine on a pure commercial basis, if somebody said to you, yes, you know, okay, there might be a regulatory issue here potentially in terms of we have to notify, but it's manageable. And the bigger problem is the loss of revenue from your business, and therefore paying X, which is less than that, is actually a viable solution, albeit an unpalatable one. Mm-hmm. Some organizations with we can all understand why, would go, yeah, actually, you know what, that might be something I would consider. Mm-hmm. But then you start to come in, you know, and I guess that you pay a ransom, you take a risk, is the reality.
You do. And you know, that's not the only cost either. You know, the cost of recovery from an incident like that is frequently the biggest cost is frequently not the actual ransom itself. It's
it's everybody that's involved in the process. It's it's the experts. You know, are you having to basically rebuild machines from the ground up? Have you are you having to basically look at your systems architecture in a in a more meaningful way? You know, what about an onward investigation that might be required with the ICO or other regulators? And that's where the real cost comes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if whatever you do, you're having to explain to the regulator that you've had to do that. It's also possible that you could be dealing with your insurers, and the benefit of insurance, you know, the benefits of insurance are obvious. Mm-hmm. And they also have connections to experts that others may not, in that they'll have people that can assist with potentially the transfer of crypto, the payment of the ransom in that forum. Because, you know, again, the question of should I pay the ransom is equally met by can I pay the ransom? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, not everybody is familiar with the ins and outs of transferring cryptocurrency, of just buying Bitcoin and actually transferring it to another wallet, and knowing how that's done, because it's quite a specific thing. It's you know, there is information out there about how to do it, but it's, you know, for somebody that's never done it before, it's quite a strange concept. And then you come into all the moral issues. You know, if people keep paying, then the cyber criminals will keep doing it.
Yes, they will, because they found a business model that works. And so effectively we're then financing the refinement and improvement of malware, which is designed to ruin our own businesses.
Yeah, you're in this position where you are essentially not normalizing, but you're accepting that this is the norm. And that's challenging for lots of reasons. You're putting these, you know, you're putting them on a pedestal to some extent. You know, you're accepting that if this happens, that's how you're going to deal with it. And the challenge that that brings mm-hmm. is that if you've then not gone through the proper exercise afterwards, if you do pay and you do get your data back, of locking these people out and making sure that you've closed any exploit or loophole, that it might happen again. And mm-hmm. you know, it's unsurprising that statistically somebody who has paid a ransom is more likely to pay it again, and therefore yes. they are more likely to be attacked in that way,
to be re-victimized. Yeah, absolutely.
So you have all of those issues as well. But you know, morally, you're normalizing it, you're saying that this is okay, and almost a cost of doing business in some ways.
Yes,
you're, you know, and that's just yes. that's just life at the moment. You're yeah. There's a technical debate about, you know, to what extent at what point do the funds become the proceeds of crime, and that's beyond the scope of all of this. Mm-hmm. But you know, what are you funding? You know, where is this going? Do you know who these people are? Are you actually funding something by doing this that's very sinister? Mm-hmm. Are you, as somebody who's paying this, paying however many hundreds of thousands of pounds or millions to a terrorist group? Are you funding mm-hmm. terrorism? And then the moment you get into those territories, and it's all very specific based on what you actually know, but the moment you get into those sorts of territories, you start thinking, am I creating a regulatory risk for myself? And for my organization, am I being part of that? And you know, you would be hard pressed, I think, to find somebody that recommends paying a ransom. And of all the organizations I've dealt with and all of the experts that I've dealt with, nobody has said, I recommend that you pay the ransom because it will be a solution, mm-hmm. Because it's so risky. Mm-hmm. So I think that we will continue to see these, and mm-hmm. you know, we will continue to see it used as a blunt force instrument to cause pain. And yeah. they will pitch, what's interesting is that the people that set the values will likely pitch the value at somewhere that makes an organization think about it. And by that I mean, you know, they'll go, the pain of you being locked out of your systems is X, and you're losing Y and incurring Z in terms of dealing with this. And therefore, if I set a number which is somewhere in the middle of that, you're going to think about paying this to get rid of it. Yeah. And I can make it stop. And
well, that's the sweet spot, isn't it, Chris, where it literally does become, you know, a cost of doing business that people are considering, which is why we're hearing about, you know, businesses, some quite big businesses, stockpiling cryptocurrency in order to be able to pay potential ransoms when they pop up. And that is a change of mindset. But I do believe that we have seen a change in mindset in terms of the attitude towards changing it, because you know, you and I have been looking at this sort of stuff for probably 4 or 5 years, and you know, when it started off, there was a kind of like a shoulder shrug. You know, you get ransomed, and you know, your files or your system encrypted. But it's kind of, it's up to you really what you choose to do about it. That was the way it used to be. Then that's subtly changed into, you know, well, you shouldn't really, you know, that's probably not a good idea. At some point, that's going to turn into, you've got a responsibility not to do this. You've got a responsibility. That's what I sense. You might not agree, but that's what I sense, because I'm seeing this shift, and I'm seeing so many businesses and public sector bodies being affected by this kind of thing. But it feels to me like there will be eventually a shift to, you know, this is an irresponsible thing to do. You shouldn't be paying ransoms. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think there will be more debate about it. Mm-hmm. And I also think it will scare a lot of organisations into hopefully preparing their systems, setting mm-hmm. up their architecture. You know, there is never a 100% secure you know, rubber stamp that somebody will give you, and if somebody tells you that, then I'd think very carefully about the extent to which that can be right. Mm-hmm. Because you know, we are in an environment where we are behind, we are in an environment where we sit behind the people that are doing this on the curve. Mm-hmm. They're ahead of us, we're catching up.
They're always catching up. Yes.
And you know, there are lots of really interesting concepts around this, and you know, you get a specialist consultant in that can help, but you know, you then start to get into you know, SOC as a service, you know, security operations centers, you start to get into threat, active threat hunting, more aggressive monitoring of the dark web, and seeing if you're, you know, finding out if you're being targeted, if there's any chatter about you, practicing good cybersecurity. And I think there will also be a greater shift towards that. And you're already starting to see it in terms of, you know, I've certainly seen lots of organizations now being asked, whenever they're doing something, you know, can I see your cyber essentials certificate? And I think it's becoming a prerequisite sometimes for the for data being transferred. And then, you know, whilst that's not the complete solution in its entirety, it's a step in the right direction. You know, if you've got somebody that's kind of got Cyber Essentials Plus, and is kind of actively thinking about their system and their data, then, you know, you'd like to think that statistically it's more likely that they've started to put provisions in place to protect their business. And I think that's the that's one of the other shifts, you know, that we'll start to see. There'll be that the emphasis around that will be huge. And then it's and then there will be lots of onward litigation about it. I mean, we've dealt with it on, you know, on both sides of the fence. We've dealt with it as a party that is the subject of the ransomware, and we've also dealt with it as the party who's given their data to somebody else who is subject to ransomware. And the way in which it's dealt with on each occasion, of course, differs, and you have to make sure that that you're asking the right questions. And it's a new and emerging area, and no instant response is the same. But yeah, I think unfortunately there'll be more, there'll be a lot more of this. A lot more of this in the future.
I think so too, and I think that the questions around sort of cyber essentials plus, and certifications like ISO 27001, you know, they've all got a place to play. And as you say, it's a great starting point. I think they're a tremendous starting point. But I mean, we always say to our clients that you should still be able to audit. You know, there should still be a right to audit, regardless of whatever the certifications that they're holding or what they're compliant to, for the simple reason that it's a bit like vetting. So it was correct at the time, it was current at the time that they filled in their questionnaire or were audited at that particular time. But, you know, making sure that someone's security posture is a consistent thing and it's a living, breathing thing and part of their organisation. You know, you can ask to see someone's certificate, but unless you can actually back that up yourself with an audit, then, you know, you're still in a situation of kind of taking their word for it in many respects. And I think you're quite right. As we start to see more and more of this, which, you know, as you quite rightly say, I can see no reason why not. Then I think that an awareness of that and a desire to do that, we're going to start seeing it built into, you know, service level agreements and things like that, that they have got a right to audit and check, receive assurance on that security posture.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there'll be more emphasis on that going forward in terms of that right to audit and how you trigger that and what it actually means, you know, and how you put appropriate safeguards in place to allow you to, well, one, to allow your customers to do that if you're on that side of the fence, and to give them that comfort and to do it easily. And two, you know, how you, if you are on the other side of the fence and you're asking for that information, how you know that the information that you're getting or the audit that you're getting is not just genuine, but, you know, you're asking the right questions.
Yes,
and that's where working with working with you guys and others is the you know, gives an organization the ability to do that, to make sure they do ask the right questions.
Yeah, important stuff. Well, I can see that we've been joined by Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Morning, Mike.
Good morning.
So we've been talking about ransomware. The next topic, you've arrived just in time, actually, Mike, because we're just about to start talking about post-Brexit data protection and privacy.
Yes, it's interesting what you were saying there about the right to audit, because I think also what organisations need to appreciate is how the controls they're selecting when they're looking at partnering with other organizations and sharing information with other organizations is how all of that is going to link in with their risk appetite. So, you know, if you've got a circle of trust of organizations who have a common set of core values, business objectives, work within similar arenas, have a common maturity around information management and data protection, then your appetite for risk can be much higher and you can do a much lower level of due diligence. It's those edge cases where you're wanting to work with organizations who are perhaps unknown to you, outside of your sphere, outside of your particular business area or discipline or sector, that you need to be prepared to do much higher level of due diligence in order to ensure that you don't leave yourself exposed around their ability to understand your information and manage your information in a way that is fitting and proper and won't leave you with a potential fine on your hands.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, this is an issue that's going to be considered even further over the next few months and years, because we've all been talking about lots of things, the US election, coronavirus and all of those things. But it's meant that nobody's talking about Brexit. And now we're back into Brexit territory. And what does that mean from a data protection perspective? And how can organizations, when carrying out that kind of risk review, consider that they've ticked all the boxes, or, you know, whatever options might be available to them? You know, where is the data that they're being given coming from? Because there'll be a lot of organizations in England that will still be dealing with businesses which are regulated or caught by GDPR, you know, if they're dealing with businesses in Europe, and therefore they're still going to have to be able to answer the same questions, and therefore the extent to which the right to audit, etc., is required, it's almost going to be doubly required for some of those businesses, I would expect. So I think that's a really interesting angle. And Ellie and I were talking earlier about some of the other solutions that some businesses are using to get around that. And, you know, you're now starting to see things like data trusts being set up in offshore jurisdictions, where a trust in an offshore jurisdiction that will essentially take an organization's data from a third country, so maybe from the US, and they will take legal responsibility for that data, but the beneficial ownership will remain with the underlying company that's given or organization that's passed it over. And what that means is that the trust is the organization that's responsible for maintaining GDPR compliance. So it's almost a way for some organizations of outsourcing their regulatory responsibilities, which causes some concerns in that if there was ever an issue, could a torch be shone on the extent to which it was reasonable or responsible for you to give your data to that trust? But actually, it opens up a new angle and potentially invites new business into the EU, you know, where they may not have been able to operate previously if the kind of regulatory burden was too high for them. So there's lots of interesting thoughts around there. I don't know if that's something you've got any ideas on.
Yeah, it's like a sort of data escrow, isn't it? It's a fascinating concept. Yeah. And of course, with what have we got? Less than 2 months to go until actual Brexit. We still don't know where we're going to sit as a nation in terms of data protection compliance, adequacy, and trusted nation state when it comes to the EU. So we may well find ourselves actually as a third country rather than operating within the current open data transfer that we've got at the moment with the EU. So something like that might actually be, you know, one of the critical ways of getting around some of these issues going forward. Yep. I know a lot of people are already looking at, you know, things like, you know, model clauses and other ways in which they can operate in the same way that we have got used to operating with countries like America and India and China, because they don't have data protection. We now find ourselves in the same world that they've been in all along.
Yeah, in so far as the responsibilities that they have to when dealing with the EU will as a third country will be the same as ours. Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, on one view, you know, you might say that actually, kind of outsourcing that responsibility is it creates opportunity, but it also creates threats, because actually, if an organisation has had to go out and send enter into a formal data transfer agreement which deals with these issues, then you know that organisation has had to think very carefully about where the data is that it's being stored, what it's doing with it, and all of the other things that that point to good cybersecurity hygiene, good data protection hygiene, and all of those things. And it therefore is the answer of handing it over to somebody else entirely, almost not necessarily almost taking away that burden, but also taking away some of the good stuff that comes from it as well, in terms of thinking holistically about why have I got this and why do I need it.
Yeah, well, as you and I both know, there's nothing like outsourcing for a board to suddenly completely stop thinking about the risks and associated levels of governance and accountability and everything else. But also, it's nothing like uncertainty for there to create a market, as we've seen numerous times over the last 30 years. You know, a new threat comes along and all of a sudden there's a new panacea, and that new panacea is a new piece of technology, not a new way of actually managing risk. And we have to be careful that we don't see the new, like these new SGRO agreement type setups as being the panacea, because just because we outsource some of our functions doesn't take away our accountability and our level of ownership for that information. And it certainly doesn't take away our accountability to give the data subjects the rights that they quite rightly deserve.
I think that's absolutely right. You also have an interesting moral dilemma on that as well, don't you, about whether or not that's enough? And then you run into this situation that, you know, again, Ellie and I were talking about it this morning. What happens if there is a big problem? Was it reasonable for this particular type of arrangement or outsourcing arrangement? Because outsourcing is good, you know, outsourcing as a concept is a good thing, and shouldn't be discouraged. But you know, what's the risk that comes with that, and has that risk been properly assessed? And you know, then all the technical questions follow about notifying data subjects and how is that dealt with, and you start to go down an entire rabbit warren about operationally, you know, how does that work? But again, you know, I guess what we need to think about is that, you know, when there's a challenge or a regulatory challenge or a barrier to a business doing perhaps what it needs to do, then people will look for solutions. And that's the kind of more holistic comment here. You know, businesses will have to continue to think, you know, the principles remain the same. Businesses are going to have to think about the data that they have, where they store it, why they store it, and the basis on which they're processing it. And the ones that don't do that, and the ones that don't practice that good hygiene, are going to find themselves in challenging situations potentially.
I think there's a key word in everything you've said there, Chris, which is it comes down to like, and I think what businesses like is that they like to have certainty. They like to see rules black and white. And I think there's actually about the whole of our population actually. During the pandemic, it's as soon as you go down the route of guidelines or principles, then people start to see that as something that is optional rather than something that they should be doing. It's the right thing to
do.
They have to be following the right principles of data protection because it's the right thing to do. And the legislation is there to give them that guidance and to back up those principles. The fundamental principle of doing the right thing for the right reason, because that data subjects have the fundamental rights and freedoms to expect. Businesses have to continue to follow those principles regardless of the legislation and the loopholes the legislation might occasionally occur.
I think that's absolutely right. And you know, it's all about doing, you know, even if it's not in the letter of the law, it's acting in the spirit of it, isn't it? What's the right thing to do here? And if organisations work on that basis, then they're, mm-hmm. then you'd like to think they're not going to be far wrong.
It's one of those times where that question pops up of, you know, yeah, I know I can do it, but should I do it?
Yeah. Like a little bit like, to some extent, the, you know, complying with some of the pandemic restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people might look at a list of restrictions and say, well, it doesn't say that I can't do X, mm-hmm. but doing X might not be in the spirit of everybody, you know, having to abide by the restrictions.
Yeah, so it becomes, you know, less a question of can I get away with this?
Yeah. I think that's right, and you know, hopefully organisations don't think about data protection in that same way. And I'd be worried if organisations were. But you know, as a kind of comment, it's an interesting kind of concept for dealing with those those points.
I'm sure Mike's got some thoughts on that one.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Oh, Chris is such an optimist.
I'd be interested to hear your experience on that, Mike.
And unfortunately, what I've seen in, you know, decades of working in data protection is that organizations have consistently seen data protection as something that they need to do the minimum that they can get away with rather than what is right. And I think you only have to look at a combination of the ongoing data breaches that we've seen in the last 20 years, followed inevitably by the somewhat trite PR statement of, we take our customers' data security very seriously, we take our data protection obligations very seriously, and in between that is the unwritten sentence, except that we just lost hundreds of thousands of them. Combined with the number of times organizations do have a data breach, and that is going to be, oh yeah, actually, we kind of never really thought about data protection as part of the process. And yeah, we never actually did a DPIA from the data subject's perspectives. We just did it as a tick box exercise because that's what we now do.
Yeah, because that's the easy way, and somebody told me that that's enough to get over the hurdle. Yeah.
And taking what Mike's just said and what Chris was saying earlier about trusts and things like that, is the amount of data breach over the last 2 years I've noticed that has effectively been caused by a third party. So caused by, you know, a supplier or a platform or a portal or, you know, a tool that wasn't actually the property of the organisation that lost the data. That seems to be the bulk of the data breaches that I've seen over the last 2 years has involved a third party.
I think that's right, isn't it? I think some organisations that haven't considered these aspects, you know, don't think about, I guess going back to that point about the trusts, you know, where do I, what if I give my data to this person and there's a problem? Mm-hmm. Should I do that? Is that the right, are there any alternative options?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the third party involvement, you know, can cause lots of issues. And as when we were talking about ransomware, I mentioned that, you know, we've assisted in investigations where it's our data that has been affected by somebody else's ransomware incident. So we've given our data to somebody and they've been locked out with ransomware. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that still creates regulatory burden on us. We still mm-hmm. have to consider, does this need to be reported to the ICO, or if there's dual regulation, does it have to be reported to the FCA or mm-hmm. to the regulator for social housing or whoever it may be? Mm-hmm. And how does that sit? And, you know, there's lots of, I guess, you know, that could be the subject of a podcast in its own right, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. The kind of that introduction of another layer of potential risk and confusion, you know, but I might be cynical.
No, I think you only have to look at the development of certain technologies over the years to see how that is almost akin to being, you know, a bit of a nuclear arms race. You know, it's not that many years ago we were all encouraged to put our data in the cloud because the cloud was more secure, more resilient than we could possibly be. Mm-hmm. Now we're being told that we need to buy cloud security and cloud resilient solutions in order to make it as secure as it used to be. So we're kind of almost kidded into moving on to the next level of technology, almost, you know, being sold these magic beans, only to then find out that we now have to contend with the fact that we've got a 30-foot beanstalk and a giant coming down the road at us.
That's a good analogy. I like that. But it's true.
It is a good one, yeah.
So, you know, yes, technology is an important part of the advancement of our capabilities, but the technology has to be balanced against our own capabilities as an organization to look after it, to manage it. You know, you're saying there about ransomware, Chris, and we know that a huge amount of ransomware is successful because of a combination of our own people not being careful enough, combined with our own technology people not managing our technology well enough. And, you know, most malware for the last 20 years has exploited vulnerabilities that it's known about but not yet acted upon.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. There's an interesting, I mean, there's a separate moral debate, isn't there, about whether or not that you should blame the staff or the organization, because, you know, a lot of people say people are the problem, people are the breakdown and everything like that. But actually, is that right? Or did the organization have a responsibility to train them? And did they train them? And you start to then come into a, you know, perhaps something that we can talk about in another podcast. In terms of that breakdown and the moral thoughts around that.
I think definitely the thoughts around training and awareness, you know, this is something that every report that I've looked at, so I've been working with Mike now for 9 years, and seeing the amount of spend on, you know, on cybersecurity and on data protection, it always seems like the training and awareness is the, you know, the poor relation always, and yet it's the part that can actually have the biggest impact. Such a huge shame. I just wanted to draw the conversation back, if I could, a little bit. I hope you don't mind, but I just wanted to draw it back a little bit to next year and to Brexit and to, you know, potential impacts. I mean, we've talked about some of the data trusts, which is really interesting, and I'm sure everyone's going to be, you know, watching that with interest. But, you know, are there any other things that we can be looking out for that we should be talking about now ahead of Brexit?
From my perspective, I think the big thing is about making sure organisations making sure that where they do business with organisations within the EU, which, you know, it's entirely possible that they will, that they have appropriate data transfer agreements in place, which detail the manner in which that information is held and that data is held. And actually, you know, it should be a two-way street, in that the organizations within the EU who are directly caught by GDPR will need that certainty. And I think, you know, an organization that's proactive, that can say, and here's the document that you're going to need to ensure your compliance, is going to go a long way.
Ironically, when it comes down to the use of application technologies, that's probably a slightly easier ask of organisations, because most of the cloud solutions we're used to adopt are based within countries like, you know, Ireland and EU countries. So from that respect, those technologies will remain extant and compliant. It's our use of them that's going to have to be considered. So, you know, the challenge for organisations is less about where we put our citizens' data, and it's much more about what are we going to do now with data that we collect from new citizens.
Yes.
As opposed to gay citizens, because actually we're the untrustworthy country now.
Yeah, agreed. And that's why you need these agreements are required to facilitate that. And again, you come back to, if everybody was doing the right thing and storing data in the right way and telling everybody, when I take this data, this is exactly what I do with it. And this is exactly why I do it, why I deal with it in this way. And it's all secure. And I thought about my architecture and all of those things. Then you would hope that there would be less issues, because, you know, holistically, that's basically what it's trying to do. Protect the data rights of the people whose data is stored.
And if organisations had been doing the right thing all along, then GDPR would have been a breeze. But we saw what a nightmare that turned into.
You are quite, yeah. I think that's absolutely right. I think that is absolutely right.
But, thank you so much, Chris. It's been really nice to talk to you and I really appreciate it.
No, you're welcome. Thanks for inviting me back.
Thanks for joining us. I hope you enjoyed it. You can find all of our other podcasts either on our podcast page on the website or on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts.